De Washington a la selección china de personas que presentan al mundo la antorcha olímpica se ha transformado en una lección de derechos humanos para la Unión Americana. Beatriz Salas amplía la información.
Decidir sobre quiénes serán los portadores de la antorcha en la ceremonia inaugural de los Juegos Olímpicos de invierno en Pekín es la responsabilidad de China, y Estados Unidos no está en posición de hacer comentarios despectivos. Así respondió Pekín a la reciente interferencia de Washington, quien aseveró que la elección de China del atleta de la etnia Uyghur, de Nijir Dilamujian, para llevar la antorcha olímpica es un esfuerzo de Pekín para distraer la atención del llamado genocidio en la región de Xinjiang.
Los llamados comentarios de genocidio de Estados Unidos son la gran mentira del siglo y exponen su intento de politizar los Juegos Olímpicos de Invierno y su siniestra intención de utilizar el tema relacionado con Xinjiang para difamar a China.
China asimismo acusó a Estados Unidos de mentir de manera descarada sobre las minorías étnicas, mientras olvida sistemáticamente discriminaciones en su propio suelo.
Estados Unidos llevó a cabo un genocidio contra los nativos americanos en el pasado y ha discriminado sistemáticamente a las minorías raciales a largo plazo. La población de nativos americanos se ha desplomado de 5 millones a finales del siglo XV a unos 250 mil a principios del siglo XX, reduciéndose a una vigésima parte. ¿Qué es el genocidio? Las políticas que Estados Unidos ha impuesto a los nativos americanos son un verdadero genocidio.
Zhao, además de criticar la discriminación racial contra los africanos y asiáticos en Estados Unidos, dijo que elegir a una atleta de la etnia Uyghur muestra que la política de China de promover los deportes de invierno y mejorar la salud de las personas está beneficiando a individuos de todos los grupos étnicos y prueba que no existe discriminación.
Lo que Estados Unidos debería estar haciendo es revisar cuidadosamente sus propios crímenes históricos contra los nativos americanos y tomar medidas concretas para reducir la discriminación racial contra estas personas y otras minorías raciales, como los africanos y asiáticos.
China, en reiteradas ocasiones, ha instado a Estados Unidos a dejar de usar los asuntos vinculados con Xinjiang para difundir mentiras, interferir en los asuntos internos de China o intentar detener el desarrollo del país. Advierte que, de lo contrario, Pekín dará una respuesta más contundente a la luz del desarrollo de la situación. Beatriz Salas, con información de Niloufar Shakuri, Hispan TV Noticias.
Migrantes de todos los rincones del mundo duermen bajo su mismo cielo estrellado. Me los encuentro en las calles, en los cines, en los supermercados, y el olor de sus comidas me embriaga de placer. Todos ellos son mis vecinos.
Y yo aquí vivo, bajo sus leyes domésticas, pago impuestos y mis manos producen la riqueza nacional.
Soy parte de esa comunidad que vive, trabaja y sueña con una mañana mejor para nuestras familias.
Casi todos migrantes como yo, casi todos soñadores como yo.
Trabajemos, pues, en la construcción de otra nación que nos haga dignos.
Seamos los arquitectos de nuestro sueño colectivo.
Esta radio no tiene comerciales porque tú nos apoyas. Si ya has hecho una aportación económica, te damos las gracias. Si no, hazlo ahora en kpfk.org o llama al 818-985-5735.
Así llegamos al final de esta edición del Informativo Pacífica. Nuestro más profundo agradecimiento a todos los medios y personas que hicieron posible este programa. A nombre de Norma Martínez, se despide tu amigo de siempre, Fernando Velázquez. Gracias por acompañarnos.
Este y otros programas del Informativo Pacífica pueden ser escuchados o descargados en iPod o en forma tradicional en www.kpfk.org en los archivos de audio.
Told me, you know, we'll give you a day, we'll give you a week, however long it takes for you to accept our help to be healed and to become a child of God and denounce being gay.
Honoring the memory of Dr. Anonymous, coming up on the Rainbow Minute.
got three quarters of the way through several times and was like, well, I have no idea how this would end, so I have to start over. But one thing I know is I can't end a story without hope.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Nicaragua's NGO Purge targets its oldest queer group. Gay Taiwanese movie sings out a universal love song and upending the artistic process with Amanda Kayback. All that and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Joe Bainline.
And I'm John Dyer V.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending August 28, 2021. The government of Nicaragua is aiming to shut down the country's oldest LGBTQ advocacy group. The Interior Ministry has asked the National Assembly to annul the legal nonprofit status of Fundación Xiquetzal and 14 other non-governmental organizations. President.
Well, soon to come your way is the December 1st edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides 2022, the Thursday night show. We're going to be reviewing, not entirely sure, but I think a long interview with, I call him Backstory Brent Adams, who was formerly sort of the consigliere of the Footbridge Services over on Felker Street, and he still kind of has an operation over there, but it's a warming center, I guess, at the moment, which is open only really a handful of days a year. I think he may have suggested it might be 10 or 20, but I guess it's going to be open soon with cold and rainy weather coming up, but I don't know. Anyway, there's that. There's going to be a variety of interviews from the folks around the Food Not Bombs meal and a few updates regarding the most recent sweeps. Again, these mainly from Brent Adams, who seems to be the only person taking pictures of what's going on out there at Harvey West as the police come and, again, remove everybody without giving them, at least not apparently giving them real options. I don't know. I was not there to actually witness it, but based on what I heard from folks who are in the benchlands, prospects are not particularly positive. And also, depending on prospects, we may be playing a bit of the most recent Huff meeting and possibly an earlier one. So stick around and you'll find out.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
So, uncharacteristically, let's start out with a bit from the antiwar.org website, which I pretty regularly listen to in the morning for an update on mostly on Ukraine, U.S. actions, and Chinese and Russian counter-reactions as the march toward nuclear war seems to get more and more heated, and that particular eventuality more and more likely. But here's a bit of that. I recommend you take a listen to it yourself. It's free and it's online. It's at antiwar.com.
Hey, this is Dave DeCamp from antiwar.com, and this is Antiwar News for Thursday, December 1st, 2022. So the first story at the top of antiwar.com today, Congress to add $45 billion to the 2023 military budget. So the House and Senate have agreed to increase the 2023 National Defense Authorization Act, that's the NDAA, by $45 billion more than President Biden requested. This is according to a report from Politico. So the $45 billion increase was agreed on by the House and the Senate Armed Services Committees, but other details of the bill are still being finalized. So this is the annual military spending bill that they pass every year. And the increase by these two panels, it brings the total bill to $847 billion that they approved. But then when you include other programs that are outside of the jurisdiction of the Armed Services Committees, it goes up to $858 billion. And usually when NDAAs are passed, the media usually gets the final number wrong because there's usually a little added on top. That's about $10 billion. So it's $858 billion is the total, and that's huge. You know, we're approaching a $1 trillion military budget. And this is just the NDAA. You know, there's other ways that the U.S. spends on, you know, the empire that does bring military spending really to over $1 trillion. But this is just the bill that they pass every year. I mean, if you include, you know, the 60-something billion that they've signed off on for Ukraine, you know, that brings the number much higher. So $858 billion, and this is the second year in a row that Biden made a request from Congress, and they increased it, you know, by a lot. For last year's, for the 2022 NDAA, Biden asked for $753 billion, and then Congress turned around and gave him $778 billion. So that was last year, 778. This year's is 858. That's a huge increase year by year. And the Politico report said, you know, where it is right now is that the chairs of the Senate and House Armed Services Committees, they've agreed on the bill and they handed it off to congressional leadership. There's some other things to iron out in Congress, but they're looking to get this on the floor of the House as soon as next week for a vote. And then if it's passed by the House, then the Senate, and then it will be signed by President Biden into law. So it's not really clear what's going to be included in this yet, because when the House and the Senate work on their versions of the bill, they get all these amendments that these people in Congress try to add in. I mean, like hundreds, maybe even thousands that they try to include, and then they whittle them down, but they still usually include a lot. And really the big one that I've been watching is that they really want to start giving Taiwan military aid to the tune of billions each year. The latest plan that I saw in the Washington Post would give Taiwan $3 billion in military aid annually. And forget Ukraine for a moment, because they get the bulk of – they just get so much military aid now. But when it comes to the countries that get annual military aid set aside every year, Israel's the top, and they have $3.8 billion. And then this would put Taiwan at second. So it's very significant, but it's not clear what the final number for Taiwan is going to be. But I think that they're going to agree on something. And if they can't include it into the NDAA, according to this Washington Post report that came out recently, Congress, the White House, are considering asking, well, the White House would have to ask Congress to authorize it as emergency funds, and that's what they've been doing for Ukraine. So that's kind of the attitude here in Washington, is that let's start arming Taiwan like we're arming Ukraine. So that's the big amendment that I'm watching. All right, so the next one here, getting into the Ukraine stuff, the U.S. may dramatically expand training Ukrainian troops. So the U.S. is considering increasing its training of Ukrainian forces. This is according to a CNN report that cited unnamed U.S. officials. It said they're going to dramatically increase it, was the word that they used in this report. And the plan under consideration would aim to train up to 2,500 Ukrainian troops each month at a U.S. base in Germany. So the report said that since Russia invaded, the U.S. has only trained a few thousand Ukrainians to use specific weapon systems. Who knows what the real number is. But the new training program would be more sophisticated than just training them how to use, you know, the HIMARS rocket systems or whatever. And it would include infantry maneuvers and artillery training, like, you know, the kind of battles that they're fighting against Russia right now. And Ukrainians have been receiving similar training in Poland and in the UK. So the British have been training Ukrainians a lot. Over the summer, they started with the goal of training 10,000 Ukrainian troops. And this new training program that the U.S. is considering was requested by Ukraine, and it's still under review by the Biden administration at the moment. If it is approved, the training would likely take place at a U.S. Army base in Grafenwöhr, Germany. So now this is just another sign that, you know, the U.S. is planning to support this war, you know, for the long term. I think our, you know, little hope of diplomacy that we had is gone now. It seems like they're just all doubling down on supporting this, even though I think the fractures with Europe are important. So that is something that could change things. The fact that Europe is not happy with the U.S. right now. But, you know, the U.S. is also ready. Apparently they're going to open a command in Germany in 2023, specifically to oversee the U.S. Support for Ukraine, the arming and the training, you know, a whole command just dedicated to that. So that shows the attitude again, that this is a war that they're fighting against Russia, just using Ukraine. So, and also, you know, so we know that the U.S. has been training Ukrainians in Germany, and they're likely doing it in Poland too, elsewhere in Europe. But there's also, according to media reports, this hasn't been confirmed, but also hasn't been denied, that there's U.S. Special Operations Forces on the ground in Ukraine, and CIA, there's a CIA presence, so they could be doing some training inside Ukraine as well. Okay, so the next one here, the U.S. is pushing its allies to give Ukraine aid to fix its energy infrastructure. So now, you know, in light of this Russian bombardment of Ukraine's energy infrastructure and power grid, which started in October, you know, they need help. It's really, a lot of damage has been done. So Blinken, Secretary of State, he was at the NATO summit in Bucharest on Wednesday. I believe that was the final day. So that summit is over. But he said that the U.S. and its allies have agreed to form a group to help repair Ukraine's energy infrastructure. The State Department announced on Tuesday that it would provide Ukraine with $53 million in aid for power grid repairs, as Russian strikes have left millions of Ukrainians without power, water, and heat. And it is very cold in Ukraine right now. So it's a really bad situation. And the situation doesn't seem like it's going to improve anytime soon. Ukrainian energy providers are saying that they're going to have to be dealing with blackouts until at least March. And now, you know, I don't know if that factors in more Russian strikes, because those, you know, they could keep doing this. Ukrainian officials have said that the strikes have damaged about half of the country's energy infrastructure. And so the U.S. has been leading these meetings on military aid for Ukraine, known as the Ukraine Defense Contact Group. And according to the New York Times, the U.S. is looking to set up a similar group to rally countries to give Ukraine more assistance to repair their power grid. So they want to start this. That's what they're expecting. I guess that's what they think Ukraine needs, is that much support. And Blinken met with Dmytro Kuleba. He's the Ukrainian foreign minister, and they talked about this. And while the U.S. and NATO are saying that they're, you know, looking to help Ukraine repair its power grid, they're also pursuing policies that will make Russian strikes on energy infrastructure more likely. Because these Russian strikes started in October, they weren't doing this war tactic that is common of, you know, U.S. invasions. That's usually the first thing the U.S. does. Like when they invaded Iraq, they destroyed the country's infrastructure. Russia started doing this in October, and they did it right after the truck bombing of the Kerch Bridge, which connects Crimea to the Russian mainland. So every time we've seen, I remember there was the drone attack in Sevastopol the day or 2 days afterward. Huge Russian attacks on Ukraine's energy infrastructure. It seems to be a reaction to the attacks in Crimea. Not saying that they didn't plan on doing it in the first place, or that they didn't plan on doing it anyway. But it definitely seems like there's usually a major reaction. And NATO members have encouraged attacks in Crimea, including the U.S., and they back Ukraine's goal of retaking the peninsula, which is clearly just a huge red line. I mean, this whole thing's a red line for Russia, obviously, but attacks on Crimea, you could tell Russia's going to really escalate if there's more attacks in Crimea. All right, the last news story is a good one. Australia's prime minister tells the U.S. to drop charges against Julian Assange. So this is Anthony Albanese, who is still relatively new. I believe he came in earlier this year. He said that he has personally asked the U.S. government to drop its case against WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, who is an Australian citizen, which makes his persecution, all the more absurd that he's not even American. So Albanese, he's previously rejected public pressure to push for Assange's release, but he said that he has raised the issue with U.S. officials in recent meetings. He said, quote, "The government will continue to act in a diplomatic way, but can I assure the member that I have raised this personally with representatives of the United States government? My position is clear and has been made clear to the U.S. administration that it is time that this matter be brought to a close," end quote. So he said this to Australia's parliament. Good to see, because it comes after that letter from the New York Times and four other major European news organizations who worked with WikiLeaks to publish the State Department cables. And, you know, they sent a letter this week to the U.S. government saying that publishing is not a crime and that he must be released. The letter acknowledged that Assange's work is in the public interest and is a core part of the daily work of journalists. So with all this pressure and these are very significant things that happened this week when it comes to Assange, I was hoping, you know, during the White House press briefing, maybe a journalist would ask about it, but of course not. So I dropped a line to the Department of Justice, because they're the ones that have indicted Assange on espionage for doing journalism, for publishing government secrets and exposing war crimes and torture. That's what it's about. You know, he didn't do anything illegal. I asked him, in light of this letter and what Albanese said, is dropping the charges being considered, or is there even a discussion about it? And they declined to comment, which wasn't a surprise. I was surprised that they got back to me. I'm going to try to see if I could get a hold of the White House, but they probably won't comment to me, you know, either. So hopefully a journalist in the press corps does their job and asks about this, because, you know, if Assange is extradited and convicted for publishing something that the U.S. government doesn't want, then they could be next. But that is it for the news. We have good viewpoints. We have one from Medea Benjamin from Code Pink and Nicholas J.S. Davies about 8 reasons why now is a good time for a Ukraine ceasefire and peace talks.
And here, straight off the antiwar.com website, is that article by Medea Benjamin and Nicholas J.S. Davies. As the war in Ukraine has dragged on for 9 months and a cold winter is setting in, people all over the world are calling for a Christmas truce, hearkening back to the inspirational Christmas truce of 1914. In the midst of World War I, back in 1914, warring soldiers put down their guns and celebrated the holiday together in the no man's land between their trenches. This spontaneous reconciliation and fraternization has been over the years a symbol of hope and courage. Here are eight reasons why this holiday season, too, offers the potential for peace and a chance to move the conflict in Ukraine from the battlefield to the negotiating table. One, the first and most urgent reason is the incredible daily death and suffering in Ukraine and the chance to save millions more Ukrainians from being forced to leave their homes, their belongings, and the conscripted menfolk they may never see again. With Russia's bombing of key infrastructure, millions of people in Ukraine currently have no heat, electricity, or water as temperatures drop below freezing. The CEO of Ukraine's largest electrical corporation has urged millions more Ukrainians to leave the country, ostensibly for just a few months, to reduce demand on the war-damaged power network. The war has wiped out at least 35% of the country's economy, according to Ukrainian Prime Minister Denis Shambhal. The only way to halt the meltdown of the economy and the suffering of the Ukrainian people is to end the war. Two, neither side can achieve a decisive military victory, and with its recent military gains, Ukraine is in a good negotiating position. Not sure I agree with this one. It has become clear that U.S. and NATO military leaders do not believe, and possibly have never believed, that their publicly stated goal of helping Ukraine to recover Crimea and all of the Donbass, that's eastern Ukraine, by force, is militarily achievable. In fact, Ukraine's military chief of staff warned President Zelensky in April 2021 that such a goal would not be achievable without unacceptable levels of civilian and military casualties, leading him to call off plans for an escalation of the civil war at that time. That was before the Russian invasion, where there was a civil war ongoing. Biden's top military advisor, chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Mark Milley, told the Economic Club of New York on November 9th, quote, there has to be a mutual recognition that military victory is probably, in the true sense of the word, not achievable through military means. French and German military reviews of Ukraine's position are purportedly more pessimistic than U.S. ones, assessing that the current appearance of military parity between the two sides will be short-lived. This adds weight to Milley's assessment and suggests that this could well be the best chance Ukraine will get to negotiate from a position of relative strength. Three, U.S. government officials, especially in the Republican Party, are starting to balk at the prospect of continuing this enormous level of military and economic support. Having taken control of the House, Republicans are promising more scrutiny of Ukraine aid. Congressman Kevin McCarthy, who will become Speaker of the House, warned that Republicans would not write a blank check for Ukraine. This reflects the growing opposition at the base of the Republican Party, with the Wall Street Journal November poll showing that 48% of Republicans say the U.S. is doing too much to help Ukraine, up from 6% in March. Four, the war is causing upheavals in Europe. Sanctions on Russian energy have sent inflation in Europe skyrocketing and caused a devastating squeeze on energy supplies that is crippling the manufacturing sector. Europeans are increasingly feeling what the Germans media call Kriegsmüdigkeit, whatever that is. This translates as war weariness, but that is not an entirely accurate characterization of the growing popular sentiment in Europe. War wisdom may describe it better. People have had many months to consider the arguments for a long, escalating war with no clear endgame, a war that is sinking their economies into a recession, and more of them than ever now tell pollsters they would support renewed efforts to find a diplomatic solution. That includes 55% in Germany, 49% in Italy, 70% in Romania, and 92% in Hungary. Five, most of the world is calling for negotiations. We heard this at the 2022 UN General Assembly, where one after another 66 world leaders representing a majority of the world's population eloquently spoke out for peace talks. Philip Pierre, Prime Minister of St. Lucia, was one of them, pleading with Russia, Ukraine, and the Western powers, quote, to immediately end the conflict in Ukraine by undertaking immediate negotiations to permanently settle all disputes in accordance with the principles of the United Nations. As the Emir of Qatar told the assembly, or is it Qatar? I'm never sure how you spell that Middle Eastern teeny tiny country. We are fully aware of the complexities of the conflict between Russia and Ukraine and the international and global dimension to this crisis. However, we still call for an immediate ceasefire and a peaceful settlement because this is ultimately what will happen, regardless of how long this conflict will go on for. Perpetuating the crisis will not change this result. It will only increase the number of casualties and increase the disastrous repercussions on Europe, Russia, and the global economy. Six, the war in Ukraine, like all wars, is catastrophic in the environment, or for the environment. Attacks and explosions are reducing all kinds of infrastructure, railways, electrical grids, apartment buildings, oil depots, to charred rubble, filling the air with pollutants and blanketing cities with toxic waste that contaminates rivers and groundwaters. The sabotage of Russia's underwater Nord Stream pipelines supplying Russian gas to Germany led to what may have been the largest release of methane gas emissions ever recorded, amounting to the annual emissions of 1 million cars. The shelling of Ukraine's nuclear power plants, including the Zaporizhia, the largest in Europe, has raised legitimate fears of deadly radiation spreading throughout Ukraine and beyond. Meanwhile, U.S. and Western sanctions on Russian energy have triggered a bonanza for the fossil fuel industry, giving them a new justification to increase their dirty energy exploration and production and keep the world firmly on course for climate catastrophe. Seven, the war has a devastating economic impact on countries across the world. The leaders of the world's largest economies, the Group of 20, said in a declaration at the end of their November summit in Bali that the Ukraine war, quote, is causing immense human suffering and exacerbating existing fragilities in the global economy, constraining growth, increasing inflation, disrupting supply chains, heightening energy and food insecurity, and elevating financial stability risks. Our long-standing failure to invest the relatively small portion of our resources required to eradicate poverty and hunger on our otherwise rich and abundant planet already condemns millions of our brothers and sisters to squalor, misery, and early deaths. Now, this is compounded by the climate crisis, as entire communities are washed away by floodwaters, burned out by wildfires, or starved by multi-year droughts and famines. International cooperation has never been more urgently needed to confront problems that no country can solve on its own. Yet wealthy nations still prefer to put their money into weapons and war instead of adequately addressing the climate crisis, poverty, or hunger. Eight, the last reason, which dramatically reinforces all the other reasons, is the danger of nuclear war. Even if our leaders had rational reasons to favor an open-ended, ever-escalating war over a negotiated peace in Ukraine, and there are certainly powerful interests in the weapons and fossil fuel industries that would profit from that, the existential danger of what this could lead to absolutely must tip the balance in favor of peace. We recently saw how close we are to a much wider war when a single stray Ukrainian anti-aircraft missile landed in Poland and killed two people. President Zelensky refused to believe it was not a Russian missile. If Poland had taken the same position, it could have invoked NATO's mutual defense agreement and triggered a full-scale war between NATO and Russia. If another predictable incident like that leads NATO to attack Russia, it can only be a matter of time before Russia sees the use of nuclear weapons as its only option in the face of overwhelming military force. For these reasons and more, we join the faith-based leaders around the world who are calling for a Christmas truce, declaring that the holiday season presents a much-needed opportunity to recognize our compassion for one another. Together, we are convinced that the cycle of destruction, suffering, and death can be overcome. And that's by Medea Benjamin and Nicholas J.S. Davies, authors of War in Ukraine, Making Sense of a Senseless Conflict, came out this month, this book. And Medea Benjamin is the co-founder of Code Pink for Peace and the author of several books, including Inside Iran, The Real History and Politics of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And that's on the antiwar.com website. And the article is called Eight Reasons Why Now is a Good Time for a Ukraine Ceasefire and Peace Talks. And while I find a few weaknesses in this argument and contradictions, one of them is you're going to hear some left sources, and this is a left article, you're going to hear some sources saying that one of the reasons that Ukraine needs to negotiate with the Russians is because they are essentially doomed to be overwhelmed by force by the Russians as the ground freezes over and the massive Russian military forces respond because they've been essentially bleeding the Ukrainians out. So there is a claim, and on the one hand, that the Ukraine should act now because it's facing overwhelming force. But as you hear in this article, there's also a claim that because the Ukraine has gained a bit of territory, I think Kherson was taken, the city of Kherson was regained from the Russians, that the Ukraine is in a favorable position, a stronger position. Well, it's hard to say it's both strong and weak. Particularly if the same side, which I'm on, really, the left-wing side, is arguing that we shouldn't be there, NATO shouldn't be there, NATO shouldn't be provoking Russia this way, that there has been a civil war ongoing caused by the repression of the Russian population in eastern Ukraine, and that the U.S. helped organize or at least support and dictate the membership even in the leadership that succeeded in a coup in 2014 that threw out the elected somewhat pro-Russian president, Yanukovych, I think his name was. There's a tendency to grab what arguments you can to say, get the hell out of there before we get some sort of nuclear confrontation, which to me has always been one of the major reasons why you don't want that to happen. Why you don't want U.S. sending in huge amounts of arms as it's now doing, to the tune of multiple tens of billions of dollars. Anyway, let's try to forget all this, or maybe remember it as we hear a little music. The Sun is Burning by Simon and Garfunkel on their album Wednesday Morning 3 a.m. And I'm going to begin by playing Brent Adams' interview, an interview with him from a couple days back, which covered I was prompted by a conversation with Reggie Meisler, who's an activist who appealed the oversized vehicle ordinance, which is a law the city council passed to try to criminalize people living in their vehicles in Santa Cruz and to make it an inhospitable place for them to come and to drive away the folks who are parked on Delaware and other places in town, because the only shelter for many people, and certainly a better shelter than a tent, is a vehicle. Anyway, Brent had some photos of the latest sweep, which many of us, or some of us anyway, I certainly was predicting was going to be happening following the massive demolition of the benchlands, with virtually none of the media looking and none of the activists too involved, at the Harvey West encampment, which was coincidentally at the site where Brent Adams had encouraged people to go, or had followed people to, I'm not sure which came first, after the duck pond police threat of 2020 in the winter, when the police threatened everybody who was in both the benchlands and the San Lorenzo Park upper duck pond area with arrest and property confiscation if they didn't leave, although without giving them a place to go, of course, really, for the numbers of people who were there. And this was 2 years ago, and at that point, some people went to Harvey West. Brent assisted them. He was then, again, working with it wasn't called Footbridge Services at that time. It was the warming center and the storage facility and so forth on Filker Street. But he encouraged people or assisted them as they went to Harvey West. And that's where some people also went after the demolition of the benchlands, the latest benchlands encampment. And that was broken up by police a couple of days ago. And Brent came and took a few photos. He talks about it in the interview a little bit, but he wasn't able to stay for the actual get out or get arrested culmination of it. However, he did write a little bit about it yesterday. Or actually, yeah, I guess it would be yesterday if you're listening to this on Thursday, December 1st. We're angered that after more than, he actually wrote about a day before yesterday. It was yesterday, sorry. As the city of Santa Cruz now plays whack-a-mole with those forced from San Lorenzo Park benchlands, people have now been pushed out of Harvey West Park and are now strewn around this light industrial zone or beginning to be contacted by the inhospitable SCPD. We could easily do this better, but Santa Cruz residents get the quality of community they ask for, which is nothing. And some weeks ago, Brent wrote on his new website, relatively new to me, which is called We Are Santa Cruz. If you go to Facebook, not a website, I guess, but a Facebook page, We Are Santa Cruz, not an authentic transitional encampment, from an ill-performing charging station to a lack of authentic community meeting space, the city-run transitional camp, he's talking about 1220 River Street, I believe, is a far cry from what community members who'd researched and planned for and what hundreds of people had demanded over many years. We need a mission-oriented, non-profit-run transitional camp that's more focused on helping people to heal people than it is to make fake points at city council meetings. And I think he's talking about 1220 River, though that has been spoken of as a better encampment than the Armory, which is an indoor encampment in a building, and the Overlook, which is right nearby. But I'm not entirely sure. But in any case, he's referencing at least one of those city encampments. And he also wrote on November 7th, the city of Santa Cruz reports to spending $250,000 on cleanup of the San Lorenzo Park benchlands. They lied to the community and the press, stating there were ample shelter spaces for everyone in the benchlands, though not admitting to lack of desirability. Many people did access shelter at the Armory, though many of those left it behind. Here we see dozens of people lining the San Lorenzo River in makeshift camps as they've been forced out of the park. Many dozens more are in Sycamore Grove, the Poganip, and other natural spaces. You've likely noted tents popping up near to your neighborhood also. We as a community need to be more aware of the hardships of those outside and the city-county-supported trauma they're facing. We need to begin demanding better options for them, such as authentic community-oriented transitional encampments, neighborhood-appropriate agreement camps, a more robust car camping program, funding for warming centers, as well as traditional drop-in emergency homeless shelters for some. If we're going to spend all available funding on pretending to place people in non-existent housing, we need to also focus on needs-oriented programs such as Footbridge Services Center. Without this community interaction, city and county officials like Larry Mwale and Robert Rettner, who's the head of the county homeless sort of empire, will continue this comedy of errors. And he also has written, and here I must take issue with Brandon. Actually, this comes up in our conversation, which you're going to hear at some length in a moment. We're angered, writes Brent, yesterday I think it was, that after more than 2 years of demanding such food not bomb still refuses to hang any one of the available lists of homeless services. He also says it's food, not information, is how he satirizes or criticizes food, not bombs. We believe that despite the offer of a plate of food served at a busy intersection, Keith McHenry exploits the suffering of those he serves, leaving them ignorant of the many much-needed services. We as a community must demand better than this. How telling is it that on the board in the photo there is a list of all Santa Cruz SCPD police officers and badge numbers, but no mention of Homeless Persons Health Project or Mental Health Client Action Network and many others. And he's a picture of the board, the kind of small bulletin board that's put up at the town clock every day between 12 and 3, which I donated and which I'm the person who puts up most of the flyers. I guess Keith puts up some of them. But the reason I'm mentioning this and Brent's criticism is because it's not entirely complete. One has to do some full disclosure here. I gave Brent Adams $20 to put up the Santa Cruz Free Guide, which is an inaccurate and outdated online service that was originally created by Merity, an activist from 5 or 6 years ago, and is now being taken over by Evan Morrison, but hasn't been dated and has essentially no walk-in shelter and doesn't mention that it does, and has outdated references to other shelter options that are supposedly there. So I don't like to see unnecessary conflict between activists. I mean, activists disagree. I've disagreed with Keith and Alicia and with Brent, and and that happens, and that's fine. However, we all really are intent on the same goal, I think. That's what I believe. Still, I don't like to see unnecessary conflict. So I gave him $20, gave Brent $20, and said, he put up the flyers that you think should be put up and see if they disappear. And I went to Keith and said, don't take down the flyers if you're taking them down, or can you maybe see that you can't really stop people from taking down flyers, but don't do that yourself. And he agreed to that, too. But Brent acknowledged that he never really did put them up, and he's still walking around with my $20 in his pocket. So, wow. But the problem also is that this flyer, the Santa Cruz Free Guide, isn't accurate, isn't up to date, and is part of, really, to me, city propaganda, which may be one of the reasons that it hasn't stayed up in places when it was placed before. Although, again, as I said, Brent never did that as he said he was going to. So I've offered Brent, and I sent him an email, or at least I've sent him a Facebook posting, and I guess I will send him an email that says, correct the flyer, because you know what services are open and what aren't. Send me a scanned copy. I'll print a copy, and I'll put it up, and I'll put it up whenever I go to the board. So if somebody takes it down, it'll still be available, you know. So we'll see how that one works. But now let's get into Brent's dialogue with me. And if you want to see the latest photos that Brent took of police essentially running people out of the Harvey West to another nowhere location, although it's not clear that they didn't give people a place to go, but they're, again, using the cop spots approach, the police are, which is to say they're saying, see, there are these places up at the Armory that we've reserved for anybody who wants them, so get out and go up there to a place that you may regard as a prison camp that is distant from town, where you're not allowed visitors, where you're treated essentially like someone lesser who has to follow rules and orders from people who are, you would think, you're equals, but aren't acting that way. That's the impression I'm getting from Cuso. You may remember the interviews I played on Thursday. Although some people are fine with the Armory, but some are not. And if you're going to destroy people's housing, you have to give them something that's relatively acceptable other than what has been described by more than one person as a prison-like atmosphere. So, and you hear even Brent himself criticizing the conditions in the so-called transitional encampments, even the better one at 1220 River, if I'm properly identifying that as the camp he's talking about. It's not entirely clear. It's a little unclear, based upon his Facebook posting. I paced him for the posting. So, anyway, let's listen to Brent and me go on. And on and on, and hopefully it's got some useful information, and here it is.
On the line with Brent Adams, it's the 29th of November, and I was sort of alerted to this to hear that there was a sweep yesterday at Harvey West, and in the very area where your agreement camp, you were just telling me, Brent, was previously located. Talking with Brent Adams of the Warming Center, and an all-around activist in many fields. Go ahead, Brent.
Oh, yeah, you know, I've been visiting that space out there. You know, the bummer is, you know, two years ago, at the Battle of the Duck Pond, as we like to call it, in San Lorenzo Park, the city was clamping down and going to be pushing people out. They failed, but we really realized that their list of reasons for camp closures were not inauthentic, like, you know, stealing power from the power lines, stories of trespass and defecation into neighborhoods. And there's reasons for that. You know, trespass in general around large camps is a problem, or just a reality. And other things, you know, trash removal and stuff like that, that the city could be engaged in. But we realized if you're stealing water, using water from, you know, tapping into irrigation, things like that, that is a real problem in a park. And we as community members could address it. So anyway, very quickly, we instituted a thing called agreement camps where we found a much better, more suitable park than San Lorenzo that was far away from housing. That's that far corner of Harvey West, the Freedom, what is it called, Freedom Gardens. Anyway, so we had an agreement camp there that lasted many, many months through the winter into spring.
That's at the far end of Harvey West. If you went all the way to the road where, you know, where it actually abuts the Poganip, that's more or less where the camp was.
No, kind of. It's the corner of Harvey West and Dubois, or Du Bois. It's that back corner, not the one where the cemetery is, the Evergreen Cemetery, and the main entrance to the Harvey West parking park. It's the other street, leading from Costco all the way back to
the right. Center. That's the one I was thinking of. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And so, it's where the pool is located, and they also have the Harvey West Clubhouse access there. So it's the back corner, and it's very lovely, large open green. But if you go further back, there's a little canyon land back there, and a hillside where historically people have been camping up on that hillside for many, many years, decades, out of the way, because there's no trail network for the rangers to follow up there. So it's kind of wildland. But anyway, I identified it. We did a survey of Santa Cruz, and we're like, what's the best location to answer this? What we've learned, you and I have seen over the many years, is, yeah, they don't want you to camp here or there, but for some reason, camps will pop up, and they will allow them. But we didn't see it coming. If we had known that they would have allowed certain camps in certain areas, we could have got ahead of the game and have done it better. For instance, Ross Camp is a really good example. No one saw that coming. And we could have, we could have formed a community. So we started asking the question as a nonprofit, how do we form community concepts before these things occur? What if we, I'm really afraid of occupying space as a nonprofit because I'm trying to represent a community, a more moderate part of the community, trying to be more effective rather than a stage encampment that the police are going to just shut down. So how do we plan one step better than that? If we're not going to have an organized camp authorized, like in a transitional camp, what's the next best thing? So that's what an agreement camp would be. So Harvey West was chosen. During the Duck Pond cop action, we were literally moving people there at that time. We had about 10 people and a shuttle van. So that's old news. That went for quite a while until the city wanted their Friendship Gardens back, the picnic tables, for the spring and summer barbecues and stuff like that. And it was just getting out of the pandemic, so we honored that. And then they put us, unfortunately, into the benchland.
So how long, let me interrupt you for a moment, yeah. Brent. As I understand it, from the December removal of, the attempted removal of the ducklands, which was blocked by both the community and by an injunction, you were helping folks to move who were concerned about saving their possessions. You moved some of them to the Harvey West. That must have lasted for about a year.
And on Harvey West, it only lasted until April-May.
April-May of 2021 or April-May of 2022?
21. It seemed a lot longer because it was novel, a novel approach. And a winter month, it just drags on because actually up there, people should know, it's easily 5 to 10 degrees colder than it is even at Costco. As soon as you make that little rise and you get back in that corner, it gets really cold back there. I'm not sure why. And it's one of the problems of the pogo nip in general, and it's also one of the definitions of the word pogo nip is ghost fog. It's like an extremely cold, forbidding region back there.
Mm-hmm. And then you were moved to the other side of the Benchlands encampment and set up a sort of a separate zone. I remember, we've talked about that in interviews in the past, but I guess you were saying there was an irony here in this latest raid because, maybe I'm misunderstanding you.
So what ended up happening was, over the months, I've known that people were starting to go back there, and this time around, I'm like, I wish I had the robustness of support community. I wish, rather than saying protest community, we had a community of activist doers rather than protesters. You and I have had this conversation over the decade now, which is kind of how this nonprofit started. Let's start doing things rather than protesting. But I'm hamstrung. I got way too much going on. But I want the culture to continue. So why don't they set up their own goddamn agreement camp? What's wrong with that? You know, and we'll support them with materials like, you know, garbage bags and whatever. Here's a list of the rules from last time. But already what they were doing was what we call colonizing the hillside, which is one of the city's requests that they do not do. Don't carve into that hillside. Don't go up there. And the first, 20 people just went straight up in the hillside. I'm like, please don't be up there because it's going to ruin your chances to be here. As more people were pushed out of the Pogonip, the benchlands, of course, most of them went into the Pogonip along the Highway 9 and down. And there's tons of people in the Sycamore Grove upperlands. That's it's a unique space up there in the Sycamore Grove.
Have you visited those spots, Brent?
Yeah, numerous times. I was there quite a bit yesterday, too. But a lot of people, you know, who aren't as hardy, we'll just go into Harvey West because it's way easier. You don't have to, you know, set up camp in a. It's actually, so there's a lot of flat space there. So they started, you know, a lot of by yesterday there must have been 50 or more people, and they didn't have any organization whatsoever. Trash was mounding. You could tell that there's trespass. There's lots of materials from the light industrial zone brought in. That's one of the things we request that you don't do. Treat your neighbors more respectfully, and they'll let you be there longer. But I don't know what the inception was. What, you know, we know that the device here will be that they have they can point to empty camp spots at the armory still. I'm still told that they're opening it up there. So as long as that's the case, they're able legally, I believe, to close, you know, and if, you know, people are camping in a park or a closed area, they don't even really have to have any legal reason. You're camped in an area where you're not supposed to be. But if you had it more organized and more clean and, regulated, then the city would, you know, I believe, turn a blind eye for a while. But it wasn't that. And I feel regretful that I haven't built the culture or community that could have supported the agreement.
What about the group of folks that has come together initially to support Sanctuary Village and then to support the Warming Center and the footbridge services? Haven't any of them volunteered to help out? Because they're certainly activists.
You may have noticed I'm closing many of my services. Yep. What has become of that community is two or three quick answers. One, most of those Heartland supporters are older. You know, when you see one of our fundraisers, most people have the gray hairs. Also, the second problem is the pandemic kind of was a watershed, you know, moment. We lost a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And we lost people, new converts, to one of two things that I've been preaching quite a bit over the last year or two. Housing first is mesmerizing, and people go in that direction, and they think that the work that I'm doing is just a Band-Aid and perpetuates homelessness rather than improves it and heals it.
And for those who don't know, and that won't be many people, but describe what Housing First is from your
perspective. Housing First is a national mandate from the federal government that just simply says shelter doesn't end homelessness. Housing ends homelessness. And that's kind of like a dumbed-down thinking that we're going to be putting people into housing now. And so they put billions of dollars nationally into it, but it's been wildly unsuccessful. Every single city, you can't point to any real success stories. And the one that they do find have, you know, special criteria based either a really large, strangely large housing stock available, which we don't have in any city on the West Coast. So we've been at war with that for a long time, that idea, which Santa Cruz and all the counties along the West Coast here have adopted because it feels good. And also it gives them a place to put money, and it's almost like the new old boys network where the money is shared among themselves and their city and county partners, and the money just goes away. And where, we don't know, but it's salaries, buildings, into an infrastructure that doesn't actually that puts people into non-existent housing. When they do get into housing, it's not a healthy type of relationship. People, most people, fall back to the street. So we, so it's kind of well-intentioned, misinformed, you know. And I would think these professionals would know better that homelessness is not a function of lack of housing. Even Keith McHenry and people left of us will say it is. It's actually a function of dual diagnosis and people who are missing the tools and don't have the community support network that can help them maintain housing once they get it, if there were, was any housing.
Well, rents may have something to do with it, Brent.
No, no, it certainly does. But, no, you can drop almost any of these people that we know outside into housing and it won't last. It's not because people, the landlords just aren't, just because they get money doesn't mean they want you in their space, and we're not building large complexes. It's just kind of like we on the left here are a little bit, blurry-eyed about what actual housing for homelessness means.
And I think I take issue with Brent here because I think that this idea of treating the problem as a non-housing problem, but one as a mental health problem and a drug addiction problem, though these things are certainly a part of that whole issue, is an attempt to conveniently dismiss the obvious solution, which is to provide real housing, although it's very expensive unless you want to start confiscating the excess housing that the profiteering speculators and the excess amounts of money being granted to folks who already have housing and who get additional tax benefits from it, whereas renters do not, unless you want to resolve those issues, which could provide, or if you want to shift the money from the military to the, from that that's going to the Ukraine and to the bases, to maintain bases all around the world, making the U.S. military expenditures nine times that of the, it's either nine times that of Russia or nine times that of all the other military expenditures of all the other countries combined. I'm a little fuzzy on that point at the moment. Probably the nine times that of Russia. In any case, let's take a musical break while we ponder this question and get back to the dialogue.
I was alone. there were others just like me. Oh, what shall you find in those ruins of my old home, that dead city?
For the hearing challenged, or possibly just you, if you're getting your own understanding of the lyrics drowned out by the loud music, I hear the sirens calling. They wake me from my dreams. I look outside my window and hear the curdling screams. I wonder how we got here, the sins we must have done. I ran and ran all in fear for the rise of the midnight sun. I don't remember where I hid in water or basements cold. All I recall is the silence for the roar of the volume untold. I don't know how I survived. In truth, I couldn't say, for I thought that I had died. Oh, I tried to forget that day. No, I don't think I was alone. There were others just like me. What shall ye find in those ruins of my old home, that dead city? So, although I guess there may be some survivors, there probably will be a few, in the immediate aftermath of a nuclear war, depending on, I don't know, whether the bombs are airburst and where they're burst, and I guess how many hit the southern hemisphere, the question of whether there'll be any significant number of survivors a year later, or that the Earth will be able to sustain mammalian life, or human life, even, or, you know, any kind of life, considering the possibilities of nuclear winter, is a real question. So we're talking about, you don't have to wait for climate change to do you in. You can take the easy way out. I don't know. Send more arms to Ukraine, and let's go toe-to-toe with the Ruskies. Anyway, let's get back to Brent Adams and me going, well, I wouldn't call us going toe-to-toe, but we're talking.
Providing housing and dropping the rents and making it available means automatically our people will be housed. No, it's not true. We've seen enough evidence over the many years of people getting into and then right out of and into and out of, and it just. But what we're not doing is protecting, you know, raising the floor experience and make sure everybody has everything that they need out here, which is laundry, storage, showers, all the 100 elements of things from Q-tips to blankets that a person needs to thrive, and then mental health support in a way that's beneficial to them. You'll see mental health support that's available now in a way that's not beneficial to them. To visit Building K on any day, you'll see, you know, you'll scratch your head and let you, you know, if this is the mental health space, it looks like a .com place that nobody visits.
That's Emmeline you're talking about.
Emmeline, yeah. Building K.
Well, I have to say, though, that, I mean, in my recent interviews, although I'd be curious if you have any actual stats on failures of people to be able to use housing that they've gotten into, because that's an argument used by right-wingers as well, you know, as well as left-wingers or individuals who are in centrists. But I know that I've run into people who claim that they've recently lost housing they had for 8 or 9 years here. And then the landlord decided to raise the rent. You know,
what we've seen is people get into housing. It's a year lease, and the lease is not renewed. Why? Because they can get anybody else into that space. The people who are accepting Section 8 vouchers should be deified. They don't have to be doing that. That's something that's, you know, a very altruistic Christian type behavior, but they'd much prefer have techies, or it's a seller's market here. Just because the government is insuring your rent and giving you $1,000 bonus doesn't mean you want somebody who's been on the street for many years to be in your back bedroom.
Right, but it may not be because they're not well trained or anything. It may be because if you have somebody who is more upwardly mobile. They can, that's an opportunity to raise the rent at a future time. It made me feel more comfortable with that kind of a person. In other words, I don't know if I would buy the idea, unless I've seen the documentation that that's the case, that it's generally true what you're saying, that, you know, it's the absence
of... I would say it's more cultural. I butt in on you. I'm sorry, Ruth.
Yeah, no, I agree with you on that, too, that it is cultural, but it's, I don't think that even improved mental health services that really deal with people in crisis instead of doping them up, you know, and sending them off, and you know, drug abuse programs that actually work instead of take in money and then leave you on the street in 30 days without any place to go. You know, that would be certainly an improvement, but I don't know if I tend to suspect, and I don't have good documentation either, so I can't say to you it's a rental problem, it's a medical expenses problem. You know, I can't honestly say that in terms of the documentation, but I have tended to believe that is the case, and I'd like, you know, I'm always eager to see people who've actually collated data that would show it one way or the other. So.
We've heard the term evidence-based practices, which, you know, comes from the medical industry. We've heard that for a decade now relating to Housing First, and they never pointed to a data set to support, you know, the entire paradigm shift, that they've taken over the HAP, they've taken over everything, you know, everything relating to, look at the city is done. They now four-wall all of homelessness in the city, you know. A few short years ago, it wasn't like that. We would have only prayed for the city to be engaged at any level. But now they're controlling the entire space. You know what I mean? You know, they're getting the $12 million or whatever. They're spending it the way they want to. They dole it out, and they're just kind of like doing homelessness now. They're doing homeless camps, you know, in our parks, at the Armory. 12:20, then, you know, whatever, blah, blah, blah.
They're kind of token homeless camps, though. I mean, they're not...
Right. But things have... It's hard for you and I to, you know, people don't... You know, Paul Lee, you know, rest his soul, had some knowledge, you know, farther back, like you do, and maybe even Don Lane, a few others. And then I come on the scene, you know, halfway, talking shit about everything, and you know, you kind of like... We did a lot of shaming of city council because we believed it could be a different way, but now it's like it's the game has changed in such a way that's kind of why I'm getting out. Well, let me get back to brass tacks here. The other part of it is, besides Housing First, you know, the protest tendency, and then we've talked about that too, very idealistic people will look at homelessness, people from the left of me or the right of me, and will make up their mind about what things are and how things, you know, if they want to devote their volunteer hours or their funding to help the thing, you know, we're kind of, we position ourselves smack dab in the middle, that we believe people outside, let's really help minister to their needs, you know, make sure that they have the shit that they need. People on the extreme left really don't support that. They want to see a shift in values and, you know, I don't know what, you know, so usually we see it in protest or what I call performative behaviors. Largely, if you chart the last 2 years, you go to, sanitation for the people, leading to Santa Cruz Cares, leading to Joy Schindeldecker's candidacy. That's kind of what we got with, you know, the red flag of homeless activism. And, you know, so I have a real problem with that because it didn't really authentically go into, you know, how do you protect people from hypothermia? How do we improve camps forever? You know, we're missing the OVO successes, protest successes, right? But oversized vehicle ordinance.
They
really, you know, that was a success. I got credit to them. But still, they won and the RVs are out there on the streets, we still don't have a culture.
And they're getting ticketed now, too. So.
What's that?
They're getting ticketed now, too. So.
Well, sure, that's going to happen only because it's the California vehicle ordinance, the code. You can't get around that.
Well, it depends on whether it's being properly used. It depends on whether it's being used as a pretext or being used, you know, in an honest way, but requiring people to leave every 7 hours.
Well, I mean, if you ever get a parking ticket, how do you know?
Well, I don't know. There are more mechanisms, I guess, that are going into parking meter analysis or parking meter documentation.
Yeah, you can say, like, you know, this ticket is because my car's shabby.
You can always claim that. The question, though, is I think there are also ways to document whether you've moved your vehicle, and they gave you a ticket anyway.
That's true. Oh, well, that's easily. I've done that numerous times. You know, when you have an RV and you have a cell phone, you just need to be taking pictures a lot.
Yeah.
Take a picture of your odometer. Take a picture of the place where it's parked.
Right. But the problem here is the process is the punishment. In order to get there, first of all, you don't get to a regular court. You get to an administrator who is essentially in the same structure that gave you the tickets. See?
No. You just go to the window on Locust Street and show them, and then they'll.
Have you actually found that you could do that?
Yeah. I mean, no. You have to. You're right. You have to apply. You have to write a petition. But I've had numerous tickets, you know, because I had a shuttle, a box truck, and an RV plus my Sienna van out there before I get this facility here. So I was juggling 4 or 5 large vehicles downtown. It was maddening, and I got tickets like crazy. And many of them I got, turned down.
What was the average time it took you to address a ticket? And the amount of energy that you had?
I don't remember. What I would do is... A lot of the tickets were valid. What they did was, because 3 of my vehicles are over 21 feet, I had a real difficult time.
Hmm.
I thought I could get away with it here or there, and I would get tickets, and I would laugh it off, going to the cost of doing business as a warming center nonprofit. But I thought it was timely. I didn't have a problem with it back then. But that's 5 years ago, Robert. So hmm. But again, let me get back here.
What happened? Let's talk about what happened yesterday, because I think that...
That's what I want to do.
Please.
Well, I was told by somebody here, one of my Flippers clients, oh, people started calling me saying, oh, dude, we need, they're coming. Apparently the notice is from the 22nd, which is the Thanksgiving week, right? It's Monday. They went out there on Thanksgiving week when everyone is, you'd think that the city would be shut down. People are on vacation. Definitely activists are not available, usually on that week. And they posted a notification that it would be closed on the 28th, which is a week later, only days after Thanksgiving, the Monday after the Thanksgiving weekend. So that's really in bad spirit, really bad taste on my part on Seneca's Police Department, Larry and Wally. And Megan Bunch, who I photographed out there yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
So I went out there to see myself, and they had the entire street blocked off. They had, you know, the 8 cops standing in a circle waiting. But I had business, so I couldn't be out there during the actual shutting down.
Mm-hmm.
I was told at 12 noon yesterday they were going to do it, so I was out there at about 11 taking pictures.
Mm-hmm.
Megan Bunch arrived. Megan Bunch of the city, Santa Cruz, city manager's office, so she's assistant to assistant or some sort of thing like that,
mm-hmm.
focusing exclusively on homelessness. Yeah, Susie O'Hare's long gone.
Yeah, I guess
Jeremy wasn't out there. There was no Imwali out there.
Did you talk to any of the people either subsequently, or have you heard anything about whether they were actually offered other accommodations?
No, they were offered. There's nothing offered. There's nothing on the flyer that indicates.
Huh. And you didn't hear?
My assumption is maybe that's what they were doing. There were 2 other people who I don't identify in the photograph standing next to Megan. If you see in the photograph, it's Megan. Another woman, Latinx woman, and a Latinx person, and a gentleman who I don't recognize.
Mm-hmm.
So they're, you know, of course they must be continually staffing. I heard there's somebody named Monica who now works with Jeremy Leonard, but I haven't met her yet. So they might have been, giving them the heads up. But I was just trying to encourage people to, you know, I'm always trying to let campers know what your options are, because for some, one thing we're not talking about, I'll just shove this in here quickly.
Sure.
You know, we've been dealing with opiates and methamphetamine of this population for many years, but fentanyl is a game changer. The people we've known and loved for many years now have a bigger monkey on their back, and it's a lot more debilitating physically and psychologically. And a lot of people have just completely surrendered. You know, I have a new term about homelessness, which is a new class of homelessness, which are what we call the unhousable. They're just never going to be housed. And a lot of people are kind of giving themselves to that category. When we're trying to say, don't do that. Give yourself some love and credit. Don't turn into an unhousable person. Fentanyl is turning a lot of people into an unhousable, so that's how bracket that. So they were there starting to break down yesterday. I made some carts available. I do have a truck to help transport, but people literally didn't know where they were going to go. So you just list the places. Well, you know, get out there on Highway 9 and head up. You can go to the Sycamore Grove or up into the hill. Take the tracks further up. Try to get out there. Behind the university, there's not very many people. There's a lot of bike touring. But people who are focusing on their substance, misuse, let's say, substance use, aren't interested anymore like the good old days when people would trek out there. The intrepid camper could still has a lot of opportunity to camp in the woods and have a glorious experience. But most of our people are not that type anymore. They want to be with each other. They want to be with the source of the substance, and where they can kind of, just go out into the Poganip in the Sycamore Grove and poke around, meet people, and you'll kind of see what's up. It's just kind of a transfer of what was happening in the bench lines out there.
How did you get to the Sycamore Grove? With a bike or on foot?
Oh, I have a car.
And you could drive in?
Oh, no. You park at those pullouts along Highway 9 to the right. Sycamore Grove is sandwiched between Highway 9 and the river, and you just walk down in.
I see.
Or yeah. Most people aren't down in. They're actually up. There's a little a bluff, and they're all up on the bluff in Sycamore Grove, which is interesting. I think it's smarter because you don't get flooded. I think they're also more in a more community stance. You know, people are not off by themselves. They are kind of in collectives, and that's a smart way to do it.
Have you had much conversation with those folks?
No. Well, last week I talked to a few of them. It's interesting to see who is where. I won't name names, but it's interesting to see, how community sorts itself out and who feels safe with each other and where alliances are built. But
not since yesterday have you talked to anybody who got evicted from the encampment.
I haven't seen where they went. Yesterday I talked to a few people in Harvey West. They didn't know where they were going. I just gave them a few options. Also encouraging people to do the unexplored thing, which is almost none of these people are going to do it. They don't have a lot of physical power. They don't have a lot of resources. They usually have a broken down cart and a bike that's not in good repair. They have too much stuff. They start to do that concept of impaction. They're collecting things, but if you think you're going to be in a place for a little while, you start collecting things and shoring up your walls and creating a little more warm, comfy home space. Also, most of the tents are community spaces where they're people are inside of their tent, sharing time. I'll ask one or two people which tent's yours. They're like, oh, none of them are. I'm just here.
Hmm.
Wow, okay. I can't. It's totally foreign to me.
How many people would you estimate are at Sycamore Grove?
Oh, Sycamore Grove. By the way, I was just talking about Harvey West.
I'm sorry. So start at Harvey West and...
50 or just more than 50 at Harvey West scattered around and in that deep corner.
Mm-hmm.
Again, Sycamore Grove, I would say 50 or a little more. Poconip, you got to have 50 to 100 out there.
And we're going to pause for another musical break. I will say that when I went down to talk to folks at Food Not Bombs and had a number of interviews, which you're going to hear some of them after this Brent interview, I asked if anybody had any word on, had anybody trailed in from the Harvey West demolition or evictions. I talked to three or four groups of people, maybe five or ten people individually, and none of them had heard about it. So it there seems to be sort of an isolation within the homeless community as to this kind of news. Anyway, let's go musical. And by the way, that last musical number, I Hear the Sirens Calling, was by Alderaan Tyron, who I've never heard of before. And to cheer us up, well, this cheered me up 50 or 60 years ago, but not so much now.
You know, every great war produces its great hit songs. And after each war, we like to gather around the piano or the guitar and play these songs. We enjoy the songs because they remind us of how much we enjoyed the war. Now, World War III is almost upon us, as you know, by popular demand, it seems. And it occurred to me that if any songs are going to come out of World War III, we better start writing them now. So I have one here. This is a song that some of the boys will have sung to their mothers as they will have gone bravely off to World War III. There's one reference in here that I should explain. There's a reference to our leading television news commentators, Chet Huntley and David Brinkley. I feel that this is appropriate because, as you know, World War III will be the first world war to be seen on television. And I certainly hope that we all have color television by then. So long, Mom, I'm off to drop the bomb, so don't wait up for me. But while you swelter down there in your shelter, you can watch me on your TV. While we're attacking frontally, watch Brinkley and Huntley describing contrapuntally the cities we have lost. No need for you to miss a minute of the agonizing Holocaust. Yeah! Little Johnny Jones, he was a U.S. pilot, and no shrinking violet was he. He was mighty proud when World War III was declared. He wasn't scared, no siree. And this is what he said on his way to Armageddon. So long, Mom, I'm off to drop the bomb, so don't wait up for me. But though I may roam, I'll come back to my home, although it may be a pile of debris. Remember, Mommy, I'm off to get a commie, so send me a salami and try to smile somehow. I'll look for you when the war is over, an hour and a half from now.
Any other places that, I mean, I'm assuming that the authorities already know this, so I'm assuming you're not breaking any...
Yeah, what they've done was they were waiting, if you know Pogonip along the highway, let's say you're moving out of town towards Felton, that's the left-hand shoulder, and there's the lowland where people park and then drop off a bunch of stuff. It used to be wildly overgrown, now it's not. Mm-hmm. You can see the camps. What the city has done in the last week, with like they must have been working during Thanksgiving week. They got rid of all the low camps, and so now everyone is up high. In a way, that's advantageous because it's a real bummer, kind of like maybe no one has to agree with me, but to decide to take a ride up Highway 9 and just see dozens and dozens of camps and all the trash along the, you know, the roadside is bummer. So that they get up higher, you know, out of optical range is, I think, a little bit better, and this also protects them for a little bit longer. So you get fewer complaints if you're dug in better.
Mm-hmm. You've been visiting these camps with some regularity, or have you been supplying any kind of goods and services? Not that you should be.
No, I'm getting ready to do something called Warming Wednesdays. Uh-huh. Also, there's a storm looming. Uh-huh. Warming Center's first open could have been tonight. It's actually forecast to be 39 degrees, which is just above our temperature threshold. Also, I apply the activation threshold conservatively at the beginning of the season, trying to get, you know, and wait till people get a little more battered so I can, you know, maybe you've heard me say warming centers all over the country close because they burn out financially or they're volunteers. So I'm usually really sensitive to that. I apply it conservatively and then, so Warming Wednesday, letting people know, and then today I'll be posting signs out there that on Wednesdays we open our gate for materials only between 12 and 3 every Wednesday. That's all hypothermia-related materials, blankets, and then clothing, things like that, hand warmers. But also I've just been going out there because it's pretty close to me. So if I'm going to get coffee or visit a friend at the tannery or Costco, then I just swing up there. It's only, you know, less than a quarter of a mile to get to Sycamore Grove.
Incidentally, I was invited on the Crohn Squid Show, the SQED or whatever it is.
Gross.
You get to hear me blathering along with Chris. If you tune in between 5 and 6, well, it's gone by the time we play this on the net. But there's an opportunity for you if you want to call in to make announcements about what you're doing, and some of the liberal intelligentsia may hear what you have to say.
Oh, I thought you already were. So what time today?
Yeah, 5 o'clock. Five to six.
I'll try to remember that.
Yeah, it's.
Things have really turned in my eyes. I'm really disappointed by Chris Crohn. Extremely disappointed. He had so much ability to champion this population, and he's just only doing Keith McHenry and other protest orientation around homelessness, and it's just, that's not, you know, that radio station is for progressive, authentic progressive liberals, not extreme, you know, homelessness is our challenge. Anyway, that's my little bitch.
Yeah, well, feel free to, you know, bitch it on the air if you want, you know, I mean,
right.
You can bitch at me too, I'll be there, whoop-a-doo.
Your friendship with me are you know, you would be a willingness to call me. Remember back in the day, even 15 years ago or 13 years ago, we would have these conversations and you would turn me down.
Really?
Yeah, you would turn the volume down while you're...
Oh, well, I would do that with everybody. I try to do it in order to control the... I guess. I don't remember the conversations I had with you, but... And I won't even be defensive, I'll say. Me, do that? Never.
You've been, We totally are. You're from the... I really appreciate you. That you would call me up and ask me my point of view when you already kind of have a tangential report from Mr. Meisler.
Yeah, I mean, you are, you know, on foot out there, keeping your eyes on what's going on. You have a strong dedication to what you're doing in spite of being burned out. You know,
right.
I mean, you.
Gonna march on for another winter here.
Yeah, and so I think I understand that you were saying that part of it is a strategic withdrawal, part of it is an acknowledgement that your own resources are limited, and you want to respect your own limits. So.
Well, also, I'm learning the weirdest fucking thing of all time, which is how far must you stretch the definition of the word integrity for it to prove itself? It's crazy. Like, if you consider yourself, you know, have integrity around your work, it could just go on forever. It's just really bizarre here.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you're comparing yourself to a standard, it can be exhausting and ultimately standard defeating.
our mission statement, the integrity of our mission statement,
right,
which is to reduce the experience of hypothermia occurrence of death do I identify.
Yeah, but to reduce it, how far? Are you doing it enough? No, you're not. Get out there and do it more.
Well, no, I mean, it's kind of like, what should I be doing? It kind of only always answers the question for you. You know what I mean? And, like, you know, I get a call. I would prefer not to do a thing, but you can't, but you have to keep doing it. Or, but also, I don't have, again, I don't have a kid, I don't have a mortgage, I don't have a wife or even a relationship to, or, you know, my own addictions, my mental health allows me to do this sort of stuff, so I just keep throwing myself in the service. But what you watched me do very brazenly recently was just hack off a whole section of what we're doing here to, you know, for self-preservation. And,
but you preserve and, yourself so you can also do the other section that you haven't hacked off.
Yeah, right. That's right. We wouldn't be able to do the warming center this year in the same way. So, yeah. But so Harvey West, it's a bummer because I wish that, you know, Chris Krohn wouldn't have known authentically what the movement is here. I say a movement of one, but what the vision is, how we could have empowered the people in the community. Like, he never utters the word warming center or footbridge or Brent Adams, and it's because it's they're all he's in, he and others are really just focusing on, you know, what's happening with Food Not Bombs. Oh yeah, Nick the Greek was murdered, which I don't believe. He was killed. But the whole thing of, you know, deifying Nick the Greek, you know, just shows how little people actually knew the guy. You know, if you knew John Burke, you know John Burke, right?
I may have known either of them, but I certainly can't place them.
Oh, John Burke is much more of an integrous person. He literally has women staying with him in his house, and they report that he's not, it's not a sexual relationship. He has low income opportunity on Pacific Avenue. He takes care of people. I've known him since Benchland's 2017. Nick, on the other hand, is crazy, if I can gaslight him, and aggressive, and started fights every time he was in my services center. He's one of the few people who was blackballed from being here because of his extreme aggression.
Hence, you didn't show up at the memorial.
Was this loving, loving, wonderful being who was, you know, anyway. But that's just a little kind of a microcosm of.
I know. I appreciate the candid assessment too, particularly from someone who's had experience. Because I covered it. I played the whole memorial on Sunday, but it, you know, I had nothing to say about it other than people would not have been in these circumstances if they'd been provided with adequate, or less likely to be in these circumstances. Even in the Benchlands, I think there was probably less violence. But you probably disagree with me on that.
Well, no, but that was an orientation around access to a substance more than it was houselessness. People can disagree, but if you spend a lot of time down there and you've been working with people one-on-one for years and seeing what their access and availability to opportunities are, it's not lack of opportunities that they're down there. It's a psychological debilitation that a substance overtakes your head, and then you're just like, that's the only option people are giving themselves. And then they can say for years, decades even, like Mama Shannon reporting that she, you know, she's being shut out. It's, you know, Blue or even Greg. Just, you know, it gets old after the 20th time you've heard it.
Mm-hmm. And you feel...
It becomes a sort of a kind of a almost a, what do you call it? Like an industry for those people. And I don't know what they get out of it, but, you know, that's why I'm getting out. At some point, I just like, that is, I can't see the thing repeating itself over and over and over and watching the city gain more ground and giving less and less. The community becoming less aware, more jaded.
Definitely call in. I'd love to have you call in and talk about that. I mean, you can talk about the rest too, of course. But if you have an opportunity, you might want to do that at 5 o'clock today.
You know, no, he normally doesn't take calls.
Well, then maybe because I never listen to his show. He just
he has kind of a rant fest where you can't call in.
Oh, great. Well, I know that, that unfortunately one of the great weaknesses of Chris is that he, I mean, I do it too, but I think he bloviates a lot. And, you know, he talks, he has a very, well, it's a sort of a booming showman approach. I mean, I do that somewhat. But I think I also try to, you know, touch down as well. And you know.
Oh, yeah, definitely, Robert. You have a more sophisticated social style than he does. More sophisticated. You have a more broad understanding of the various differences of humanity and what's happening from City Hall to the nonprofits, to, you know, the people on the street. Well, he doesn't really. He's not out there. This is his way of being out there, and he, you know, his stock approach. But we loved his brashness at many different times in the past. But then it was Chip, you know, just Chip, you know, the Downtown Association, who's now in Boulder, mm-hmm. Colorado, who told me, Brent, Chris Cohn, many times in his earlier candidacies and times in city council, had alienated really important people in the progressive community. And he's part of that wedge. We've seen a wedge being driven, and we have to, you know, ask why a politician, you know, again, that's another conversation. You've got your Micah Posner, you've got your Sandy Brown, you got your Justin Cummings, you got your Chris Crones and your Fitzmaurices, and, you know, you could just kind of, like, list their politics versus their ability to build unity. Don Lane classic, right? Mm. And what we need as a community is bridge builders rather than divisive people. And Chris Crone has only been divisive. At any point he had an opportunity to build a bridge, he instead broke the opportunity. And one classic one is when, you know, when Martine Watkins called them out and started the whole process that ruined our progressive voting block on city council only 2 years ago, 3 years ago, 2 years ago.
2019.
When they started the movement to get rid of Chris and Drew, it was largely because they, of their crazy, that progressive gentlemen would be cast as aggressive, you know, aggressive males. And they fit the pattern because of their crossed arms. Chris Crone threw his pencil down instead of demonstrating, hearing what Martine Watkins was saying, as stupid and inane and untrue as it was. The progressive liberal male has to say, oh, I hear that. I hear you for your pain. It's not my intention that you would feel that. My intention would be thus. And then state his point. Drew didn't do anything of the sort. They were defiant and would not even address the issue on the table and start some other conversation demonstrating their lack of hearing. So we really lost a lot. Chris Crone is, you know, he's not a good guy in my book.
I don't know. I mean, on that particular issue, I probably disagree with you in some respects, although I'm not. I got the impression that Watkins, you know, Martine Watkins is no babe in the woods.
Oh, no. Yeah. They should have. They on our side of the aisle, if we may say it, we should know how to do judo better than that. They beat us on our own issues. They beat us on women's issues. They beat us on people of color issues. They beat us on, you know, aggression issues, like calling us out. Those are our issues that we win, and they scored points on our side of the court, and we lost, and we played into their hands, and we lost, and now they get all the big buildings.
Well, that, you know, that is an issue I could call you about in a separate call. Because it sounds like one you could educate me on, or who knows, maybe we disagree, maybe we don't, or agree or disagree in part, I don't know. Is there more you want to say, understanding this is going to be played likely on Thursday?
I've got to get back to the desk here. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, man.
Right, be well.
You too. Bye-bye.
And that was the interview that was. Also, I did do an interview myself with Chris Krohn on Tuesday night on his show. I think it's Talk of the Town, perhaps Talk of the Bay. Anyway, it's at 5 o'clock on Tuesday on K-Squid, KSQD. If you go to KSQD.com sometime in the next 2 weeks, if you're listening to this, within 2 weeks of the 1st of December, you're likely to find it. Maybe within 2 weeks of November 29th, which I think is when it happened. And I may be playing some of it or all of it on my Sunday show, or just archiving it myself on the Huff website. It had its rocky points, but, you know, it's, and people who are familiar with my show, this show, Bathrobe Spears, Broadsides, are not going to find too much new in it. But, you know, it's mainstream or alternate mainstream radio, so there's that. It's not a call-in show, so it's just me and Krohn going on with occasional interjections by the engineer, who was concerned about use of the words fuck and bullshit and things like that. Understandably, because he is worried about an FCC license, which we no longer have to worry about here at Free Radio, although we never did. Or if we did, we didn't translate our worry into censorship, which is what mainstream media and alternative media does. But here's a little ha-ha in the musical break, a little kind of break from the more somber realities of impending nuclear war, although I don't think we should stray too far from that consciousness, because it, as I've said before, it grows every day, as far as I can see.
I always like to end on a positive note, so here is a rousing, uplifting song which is guaranteed to cheer you up.
When you attend a funeral, it is sad to think that sooner or later those you love will do the same for you. And you may have thought it tragic, not to mention other adjectives, to think of all the weeping they will do. But don't you worry, no more ashes, no more sackcloth, and an armband made of black cloth will someday nevermore adorn a sleeve. For if the bomb that drops on you gets your friends and neighbors too, there'll be nobody left behind to grieve, and we will all go together when we go. What a comforting fact that is to know. Universal bereavement, an inspiring achievement. Yes, we all will go together when we go. Together when we go, all suffused with an incandescent glow. No one will have the endurance to collect on his insurance. Lloyd's of London will be loaded when they go. We will all fry together when we fry. We'll be French fried potatoes by and by. There will be no more misery when the world is our rotisserie. Yes, we all will fry together when we fry. We will all bake together when we bake. There'll be nobody present at the wake. With complete participation in that grand incineration, nearly 3 billion hunks of well-done steak. We will all char together when we char. And let there be no moaning of the bar. Just sing out a te deum when you see that ICBM, and the party will be come as you are. We will all burn together when we burn. There'll be no need to stand and wait your turn. When it's time for the fallout and St. Peter calls us all out, we'll just drop our agendas and adjourn. We will all go together when we go. Every Hottentot and every Eskimo. When the air becomes Uranus, we will all go simultaneous. Yes, we all will go together when we all go together. Yes, course we all will go together when we go.
And that was Tom Lehrer's We Will All Go Together When We Go. He's 94 now. He may still be in the area. I think he's connected to the University of California, and his primary field is math. Visiting instructor, I believe, at some point. And still around here, maybe. Who knows? I've never run into him, as far as I know. And he's reportedly a very private person, and I'm, who knows, maybe on a future show I will talk more about him. I personally love his music, but he's also had no particular interest in publicizing the rights of homeless folks here, which, you know, I always, to some extent, that's a standard by which I judge public figures who have, I think, more responsibility to stand up for civil rights in their area, particularly the area they live in. And so, who knows? In any case, let's turn now to actual folks outside and some of their experiences, some of the interviews at the town clock and the Food Not Bombs meal.
And it didn't help. Oh, hell no.
So...
I said, oh, hell no, I prayed. Oh, hell no, please. But this kind gentleman pulls up and hands me a tarp. So I put a blanket up to block the wind. Because all of a sudden a gust came up, you know, around when we were closed. They were closing and it was, oh, it's going to hail. What are you doing?
I'm recording you.
Oh.
You're going to be on free radio.
I am not.
Unless you don't want to be.
It's free? What's it going to cost?
You don't, we don't pay you. You don't pay us.
It's just going to cost me my reputation.
Your reputation can never be higher.
Oh, God bless you.
It's a complete lie. I have no idea what your reputation is, but I still would say that.
So. Thank you. That means a lot to me.
Yeah.
And for some reason, my reputation doesn't...
Who gives a shit
about
that?
I know. That's...
Fuck
but your opinion mattered.
Oh, yeah.
Because you're you.
Well.
And I'm me. And mine matters now.
And we're talking
and I'm
with...
I'm tired of it.
We're talking with...
Oh, my. Pamela.
And Pamela, you're off to the library, and you've got a lot of stuff neatly packed here.
I have my tablet
here.
And a broken phone, but I charge it just to make it look like I still have one, because mine was stolen 4 days ago.
But you haven't been assaulted last night.
No, I was not assaulted. Just Saturday was the last assault.
And where were you located when the assault happened, if you wish to say?
Well, the last one was there by he's a kid, I think late 20s. It's his third try. The last week, the same guy.
Is it love or is it anger?
It's molest. I woke up and my blanket was moving and it was cold. And I could feel my blanket and I looked up and it was him. And I said, what do you think? I wanted to say something else. What do you think you're doing? I have a gun. I'll kill you. And I didn't have a gun, but my foot was a gun. But then I was stuck in the sleeping bag, and that scared me. But he didn't know that.
Were you alone?
Absolutely. I've been alone since 2009. Six.
Frequently assaulted alone, or do hands on the scene, or how's that going?
I've been assaulted in front of a lot of people. In a lot of places.
In Santa Cruz?
Yes, sir.
And here you are, still hale and hearty, kind of.
Well, it didn't hail last night. Oh, hell no.
Oh, hail no, you
I'm
mean?
I'm hale and hearty, H-A-L-E.
And there was no hail, H-A-L.
No, but there was some H-E-L-L going on. Somewhere. Thank goodness it wasn't here.
Have you ever slept with others in the sense as a community group or?
The church.
And why?
My family, not.
How about in Santa Cruz? Is there a reason you don't use any of these shelter services?
I was told not to come back.
And what did you do? Your reputation preceded you?
I'm not sure why I'm not sure. Well.
Didn't even tell you why you.
They have a right to stay in the same room. I'd rather not stay behind without them having a chance to defend themselves. But I plan on it in a courtroom.
So you have some tickets you have to deal with.
I do?
I don't know. Do you?
No.
Good.
I have a valid driver's license.
Well, that's good.
If I have tickets, it's put it on my tab.
I see.
I have some doctor bills that I shouldn't, because I haven't paid a doctor bill since 1956.
Which is a very healthy approach, I would say.
Thank you.
Yes. Doctors have enough money as it is. I mean.
Well, you know, I don't know. I don't.
Any reports on sweeps happening around town that you've heard about? People being swept by police recently?
Does that mean to move?
Yeah.
Yes.
What have you heard?
That they had to move.
And this was recently, or
to this morning?
Well, that's what I heard. They were doing it up at the Harvey West. Did you?
Oh, again? I don't know. I don't
know
where we're supposed to go. Let's go to Fort Ord. I'll build this big old Kwanzaa hut up in there. We'll block those windows, put a big old fire pit in the middle, put some petitions up.
Any tips for women who are sleeping alone outside?
Not that I can, many, but none that are more prevalent than others. It's dangerous. Don't do it. And then when you decide you can sleep, you can. I just pray the Lord my soul to keep, because I'm at the point in my life that I've had many times I wish he would take it under circumstances, and I've hoped that I have saved others by allowing myself to take that. I know that I have, which doesn't matter. The students aren't safe.
How long have you been in Santa Cruz?
Since March 4th.
Of this year?
Yes.
Where from originally, if you wish to say?
Why I'm in Santa Cruz. Well, I came from Chowchilla Prison to Santa Cruz with a $90,000 grant for New Life, and they threw me out after 1 week because I was accused of the third time for stealing from the same girl who found it twice. And then Kim threw me out on a Friday night at 4 o'clock and let her stay, and she found the money 2 days later.
But didn't invite you back.
On Friday night, she said, you can come back, which was completely, most people would be confused at that. I wasn't. I said, well, I don't go where I'm not wanted, and I don't stay where I'm not wanted. I never have. I was married almost 30 years, and I stayed, and I wasn't wanted. I wasn't wanted the first year we were married, but I had children, and I was only 16. But I stayed because I had a commitment.
Now you know better.
I hope so.
Oh, sounds like
I'm not married, but I am. I don't know.
Married to the outdoors, perhaps?
Always.
What's the best thing that's happened to you in the last week?
Thanksgiving.
How so?
I got to go have a really good turkey dinner and kind of peaceful here. Food Not Bombs didn't show up, so a lot of people weren't here.
Did you go to the vet's hall?
I did.
I was in there, too. It was smaller than usual, I noticed.
Well, I didn't go inside, except I think I might have used the restroom that day. I try to walk down, do a little walk. You know, when I first came in March and was homeless March 11th, I did, and I walked for months. Stayed in a lot of beaches and places, and I pushed a veteran's cart, the red. They give it to me at the 405 Vets Hall down there. The 405, the post.
Okay.
Or 200. Is it post 200? 400?
Don't know it, but I believe you.
And, man, because I was carrying it in bags like this. I would load it all up in two bags and just haul it.
When did this after March? Or?
That was March. That was probably closer to April when I was no longer kind of, I was causing trouble because I was complaining.
Complaining? You? I know, I got it. I better block the sunlight there. You're going to get, your eyes will get burned there.
I know. My biggest complaint now is I want a shelter. I can get, you know, jobs. There's many jobs. My job right now is to just stay safe and full and wait for Santa Claus.
Christmas is coming.
I know. I'm so excited. I'm gonna send all my grandchildren and children something anonymously. Really? Even my mother. Yes.
Even your mother?
Well, I have a...
What about your ex-husband?
Oh, I've got something for him.
I believe it. I don't know.
The one that's not in the bag.
I see. Never you mind.
Well, I'm going to go get more research on what these...
What's your name?
I'm Robert.
You're still Robert?
I am still Robert.
Bob.
Well, you can if you
Bob, Robert.
You can call me Babs if you'd like.
Babs?
Bobby, Uncle Bob.
Oh.
Robert's what I usually go by.
Robert's distinguished.
Yeah.
I like the name Robert.
Yeah.
Redford and Robert Duvall. And
I'll give you my card.
Oh, good.
This is stuff if you want to report anything from the streets and you can find a way to use a phone.
Well, they stole my phone. I'm trying to download my tablet, but I, without my phone to send the code, I'm going to go to the library and try to do that. Thank you, Robert. I don't have a card. They stole my wallet, but I did have one.
There you go.
It said Pamela Yvonne Cooper, Davis, Davis, Apodaca, Wharton, Apodaca, Rafeth, going to be Little Tree.
That's a mouthful.
That's who I am.
All right, then. Can I call you Pamela for short?
Or Alamap backwards.
Alamap?
Alamap backwards.
Would you rather?
Pamela, but don't take Ritalin.
I never do. Where's my hug?
Oh, or it's Pam. You can call me Map. But don't tell Swiper.
All right, Map. I'm not going to say a word.
I miss my grandchildren.
And good luck. You were going to find someone to watch your stuff, so I will leave you to that
Thank
quest.
Thank you, Robert.
Thank you, Pam. Or Thank Map you. Is the case for
I'm finding the map to the library. Santa Cruz, you need one. Trust me. And forget the conference.
All right. And more interviews at the clock, probably even more recently, if I get busy down there, on Sunday, when you may be listening to this show again. And I'll be back, at least playing some of that. Let's go out on another Tom Lehrer World War III special. Well, this one is more of a satire on the military in general, perhaps not deep enough satire, but it's more like a sneery kind of satire. But it's called It Makes a Fellow Proud to Be a Soldier. And anything which discourages people from joining this mercenary force is probably okay with me, I guess. Anyway, I liked this song when I first heard it, and I think I still like it. I just wish it was more updated. We can get this 92-year-old guy, 94-year-old guy, this old guy, to do it. He is a local, after all.
I have only comparatively recently emerged from the United States Army, so that I am now, of course, in the radioactive reserve. And the usual jokes about the Army aside, one of the many fine things one has to admit is the way that the Army has carried the American democratic ideal to its logical conclusion, in the sense that not only do they prohibit discrimination on the grounds of race, creed, and color, but also on the grounds of ability. Be that as it may, some of you may recall the publicity a few years ago attendant upon the Army's search for an official Army song to be the counterpart of the Navy's Anchors Away and the Air Force's Up in the Air, Junior Birdman, and so on. I was in basic training at the time, and I recall our platoon sergeant, who was an unfrocked Marine. Actually, the change of service had come as quite a blow to him, because it meant that he had to memorize a new serial number, which took up most of his time. At any rate, I recall this sergeant's informing me and my roommates of this rather deplorable fact that the Army didn't have any official, excuse me, didn't have no official song. And suggested that we work on this in our copious free time. Well, I submitted the following song, which is called It Makes a Fellow Proud to Be a Soldier, which I think demonstrates the proper spirit, you'll agree. However, the fact that it did not win the contest, I can ascribe only to blatant favoritism on the part of the judges.